thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 82, recorded Friday, February 24th, 2012. Haranguer for Hire. As we go to press on Monday, February 27th, we have learned that the Research Works Act is dead. It has been killed and will no longer become legislation. So keep that in mind as you listen to this edition of Digital Campus, which was recorded before we heard that piece of news. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Digital Campus. This is episode 83, and we are, again, one member short, but I think we have enough of our regulars here to make a good show for you. We have, of course, as always, Dan Cohen of dancohen.org, director of the Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Amanda.
So what have you been reading this morning, Dan, just in your normal course of reading?
What have I been reading? Reading an interesting piece in Wired magazine about the long form boom, about new data showing that people actually like to read long form writing. Seems good for academia. Maybe we can come back to that later.
Sure. We are also joined by Tom Scheinfeld, managing director of the Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media, and also of the newly revitalized foundhistory.org. You've been doing some great blogging recently, Tom.
Oh, thanks. Sorry. That's a nice way to put it. Newly revitalized. Yes, one of our friends,
who will not
Boone
go
Gurgis,
named.
No, I'm going to name Boone. I'm going to call him out. He called me out.
Yeah, seriously.
I saw that on Twitter.
Yeah.
Let the trash talking begin.
Yes, for not blogging enough, and so I don't know whether it's to show him or whether it's just I'm overwrought with guilt that I have started blogging again, and it feels good. So
I actually, you're sort of my own little superego figure there, Tom, because I've been to your project management workshop a couple of times, and you always say, "Oh, you should blog the project as it's going," and I always mean to blog more about the project that I am managing, and I never do. So
yeah, we all should. And in fact, you asked Dan what he's reading. I'm reading this morning an article about the launch of a new academic blog about European politics and policy, but in the interview with the authors of this blog, Patrick Dunleavy and Chris Gilson, who are at the London School of Economics, they say that blogging is simply one of the most important things that an academic should be doing right now. So that should I guess spur us all on. So.
Well, apparently this is the self-flagellation edition of Digital Campus, so we'll try to move away from that and into more more other flagellating kinds of stories. So I think the first story we want to talk about is, I don't think there's going to be any flagellation involved at all. We're pleased, I think, to hear an announcement, a joint announcement by Knightley, the National Institute for Technology and Liberal Education, and the Council for Library and Information Resources, acronymized as CLEAR. These two organizations have announced that they're going to produce a new scholarly publishing platform called Anvil Academic. So Dan and Tom, what do you think about this announcement? Do you think that this sounds like a promising platform for scholarly publishing?
Yeah. I mean, the short answer is yes. I mean, this is, I think, something that might be very important, in that when I talk to university press executive directors, which I do from time to time, the constant refrain I hear is that they really have no funds for research and development, and they're really at sea about how to have a rigorous digital platform for new kinds of scholarship that don't, that doesn't fit well into the print monograph or an ebook version of pure text. So I think in a sense, by outsourcing this to a common system, it's a very exciting possibility where you could have multiple university presses relying on this platform to host new kinds of digital scholarship, to publish new kinds of long form or composite digital products, still have it under the banner of the particular university press, but not having to, you know, hire a Java programmer or set up a new web server for complex digital productions by scholars. So to me, it really makes sense to kind of pull it together. I mean, it's in the same way that a lot of university presses pool, let's say, fulfillment for orders, actual physical book orders. A lot of them rely on particular centralized services for that, and rather than having their own warehouses and shipping accounts and things like that. So I think it makes a lot of sense. I still think the devil will be in the details. I did talk to some of the principals about this, and it seems like there are very good people involved, and I think they know what they're doing. And I think it will just come down to exactly what the platform will allow for. I think there'll be a tension between the flexibility of the platform to allow many different kinds of digital products to exist on it and the need for there to be, I guess, some standard number of genres or sort of structures for these digital productions to exist in. Let's say, a exhibit plus contextualization, for instance, would be one kind of genre. It'll be, I think, a little bit hard for Anvil to host, merely anything. Anything goes. But in general, I think it's a big step forward and very exciting.
Well, let me ask you this, Dan. How will this differ from something like Press Forward, which is our own initiative at the center?
I think the big difference is that Press Forward is really thinking about publishing as a decentralized product. That, for instance, in digital humanities and with our Digital Humanities Now outlet, I always call it a journal, but it's just such a terrible, we don't have a great name for it, for what this new thing is. But the assumption with something like Digital Humanities Now, which collects over the feeds of over 400 digital humanities blogs and also project updates, news, links that are being passed around on Twitter and other social media platforms. The assumption is that scholars are writing and producing in a decentralized way, that out at the fringes on individual sites or institutional sites, things are going on that deserve to be highlighted and disseminated to the digital humanities community, let's say in the case of Digital Humanities Now. So it is a decentralized process with a centralized editorial body that says, hey, this is worth looking at. Let us highlight it for you. And that process seems to work really well. I think what's going on here is that it's still working within the traditional centralized mode, that there are university presses that want to acquire scholarship, that perhaps want to charge for scholarship. And I think that's a interesting, tension that will go on here. But that act is kind of important validating bodies. And but they are centralized. I mean, there is an act of submission that goes on where you submit your monograph, or perhaps in the future you will submit your website to a particular press, and then they will verify it or peer review it. As opposed to something like Press Forward, where the assumption is stuff is kind of out there and we need to use our radar to find the good stuff that's out there.
Right. I'm optimistic about this, actually. I think the people involved are great. And I do think they've correctly identified the problems. And I think, Dan, as you said, the devil will be in the details. But if I could just play devil's advocate for a second, I guess my question about this would be, isn't the platform for, publishing digital scholarship, isn't the platform the web? Like, isn't it, don't we already have that platform? And shouldn't we, rather than trying to kind of take things off of the web and into some, I mean, they're going to be accessible by the web, but off of the kind of open web and into some other kind of system to do this. Shouldn't we figure out ways to use web native technologies? And I guess that's where Press Forward, I mean, I guess I would say that because that's where Press Forward is sort of pointing. And I do think it's sort of that inside out question. I think that this is a little bit, I worry that this is a little bit inside out and that it's trying to maintain this kind of this where you bring the scholarship into something when what we should be doing is we should be bringing the peer review to the things that are already out there on the web. That'd be my big question about this. You know, that said, I think there are probably interesting hybrid models and I think if we all need to be experimenting, which I think we all need to be doing, these are good people to have experimenting with these questions.
Yeah, I think I agree. I mean, I do think that this is an interesting model where you have initiatives like Nines and like Press Forward to some extent, which are addressing this problem of peer review at the same time as they're addressing the problem of you know, the technical platforms you need for new model scholarship. So I kind of think it's good that this project is sort of addressing only one of those problems in a way. It's assuming that the presses will handle peer review, but then they'll just take all the sort of technical difficulties off their hands. But I take your point, Tom, that in a sense, you know, why can't you just publish something on the open web that's stamped Stanford University Press and not have to go through this portal, which in itself is also kind of an imprint that promotion and tenure committees would be able to recognize. So, but nevertheless, I think that we do need that probably.
You know, I think one missing piece here about something like the Press Forward model, although I think we are trying to address that, is the question of preservation. And it is true that, you know, the decentralized model requires all those 400 people to maintain their own sites, et cetera, right? One centralized infrastructure, digital infrastructure, theoretically might be able to maintain these new digital monographs. Again, I think the terminology is going to be terrible for a while until we figure that out. Digital projects, you know, perhaps in one centralized way. I mean, in the same way that you know, here at the Roy Rosenzweig Center, we have a webmaster who maintains, you know, 120 domains, and it'd be much more nightmarish to maintain all those domains separately because a lot of them are all based on the same platform and we just need to kind of update the software all at once. So I see some reason to kind of bring it together for longevity. But I do think Tom is right in that, you know, a big difference between Press Forward and something like Anvil is, I think Anvil is using the web for publishing new objects, and Press Forward is thinking about the web as a publishing space itself, right? I mean, it is trying to be digital first or webby in its nature, as opposed to, you know, maintaining a kind of old model of submission, review, publication in that sequence with a new web infrastructure. But I really hope they succeed. I mean, I think it's something absolutely, for instance, in digital humanities that we've needed, because I think a lot of projects get flattened out in the process of becoming an article or a monograph because university presses just don't have a way to publish the original digital stuff.
Well, I think your point about preservation is a good one, and because CLEAR is involved, they will make sure to address that point. They'll make sure that these things are well-preserved, I think. All right, well, we have a great deal of open access news, and we have sort of so much of it across the spectrum that we've decided to save it for the end of the podcast. But meanwhile, I thought we might switch gears to more mainstream tech news. excuse me, I'm catching a cold. There's been a good bit of news on the operating system front, specifically some news about the next version of OS X, which is to be called Mountain Lion. But Tom and Dan, you want to, or maybe Tom, you tend to be very good at this. You want to summarize some of the upcoming changes we can expect in operating systems and what those might imply for university settings?
Sure, I can try. I mean, I you know, I don't spend much time with OS X, as much time with it as I probably should still. But I can try to summarize some of the things that are new in Mountain Lion. I mean, I think the kind of headline is with Mountain Lion, like Apple continues to bring iOS to macOS. I think they're actually even dropping the macOS. They're just calling it OS X. I think in an effort to kind of merge these two platforms, the iPhone iPad platform with the traditional Mac desktop platform, and they're bringing a lot of the kinds of things you see in a mobile operating system to the desktop, like a unified notifications center in the way that you get all your notifications on your iPhone or on your Android phone. You get, if you got a new email, you get if you got new text messages, if you've got if your apps are telling you something about they've been updated or whatever, it all kind of comes into one notification center. That's going to be in Mountain Lion. I think another interesting thing that I think probably for our listeners, maybe the most interesting thing about Mountain Lion is the new what they're calling, I think, Gateway, which is the ability to only allow signed apps to be installed on your system. So these are only things that kind of Apple has looked at and said, this is safe, this is high quality, this meets our guidelines, whatever those design or programming guidelines are. This is an app that we put our stamp of approval on, and you can install it. Now, currently, currently you can turn that on and off. You can either allow all apps to be installed, or you can set the machine so that only these signed apps are installed. Apps that come to you through primarily, I think, the Mac App Store. That's another instance where a metaphor that's taken from the mobile world, the App Store metaphor, has been brought to the desktop.
I just wanted to clarify one thing. There's a slight difference between the App Store apps and the signed apps, and then there's just a free for all setting, right?
Okay.
Just to clarify, I mean, you mostly this is correct, but the signed apps basically just have like a digital signature that it's from a particular developer. And they can distribute it from their own website if they want. They don't have to go through Apple, but they do have to sign it. In other words, they have to say, like, this is from Dan Cohen's software shop. That signature itself, which I assume is just some string that's embedded in the software, that can be revoked, thus rendering that software ineffective on your machine. What's interesting here is it's kind of a hybrid, right? It's you've got the like Disney World of the App Store, right? Where everything is reviewed by Apple. It's, paid to Apple. That's the highest setting of security in Apple's mind, and perhaps in reality as well. Then there's this hybrid setting, which will be the default, which is you could have either apps or signed apps, but you can't have unsigned apps. And that's, I think, where Apple is perhaps right that, for instance, it's hard for a virus to install itself without, a signature on it in that setting, because Gatekeeper, this new technology, will not allow that to happen, even if you've like accidentally clicked a link or downloaded something incorrectly from the internet and double-clicked on it to install it. If this Gatekeeper setting says, well, wait a second, this has to be signed by someone who's registered with under this Apple program, it won't let it install. So you have to actively go in there into the settings and say, I want anything to run on my computer, and that won't be the default. So it's interesting. I mean, I assume that Apple would love it if everything goes to the App Store, but there is this interesting hybrid mode where you just have to sign your apps. And actually, we may have to do that. For instance, here at the center, we may have to have signed apps if we're going to distribute apps onto Macs in the future.
That's interesting. I mean, from my literary criticism background, I keep flashing back to the death of the author and the rebirth of the author, actually. I mean, it's almost like software usually is, written by several people. And it's funny that you're having this mandate now of, you have to identify who's responsible for this. And of course, that'll be institutions a lot of the time. But it's also like, it's almost sort of similar to the debate about anonymity on the web, and do you have to put real names on your profiles and so on. And Apple certainly seems to be following, in a way, the Facebook model of saying, yes, there has to be a real identifiable person or organization behind everything.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder about the iCloud stuff, because they're clearly, I think the big story is they're pushing iCloud really, really hard.
Yeah.
I mean, it's already on the iOS. When I upgraded my iPhone, I mean, the first thing that happens is, hey, wouldn't you like to be on iOS? It'll make your life easier. Why don't you log in now with your Apple ID? And that's going to be the startup screen in Mountain Lion. And I don't even understand. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, and I would love to get a lawyer on this podcast to discuss this, but I think there's going to be a lot of faculty who have Macs and are going to flip this on, and all of a sudden their, you know, student evaluations and all this stuff that's really problematic legally in the university environment now is going to start existing in North Carolina, in, you know, rural North Carolina at Apple's data center. People probably won't even realize it, but they're all of a sudden, all their stuff is going to be replicated off campus. And I just think it's highly problematic. I mean, we've had this issue with Zotero where people have, you know, universities who want to buy additional storage, and but they need it, you know, encrypted, and it's got to be, can't intermingle with other things, and they worry about it. I mean, there's just all kinds of regulations about where this stuff can exist. And I just don't see any of these upcoming platforms. I mean, if you look at sort of the three big players here, Microsoft, Apple, and Google, they're all moving towards some kind of, you know, purely cloud format where the cloud is the canonical version.
I mean, Microsoft had an announcement this week.
SkyDrive, right?
Same thing. SkyDrive is going to be built right into Windows 8, probably, you know, very similarly to the way that iCloud is built into Mountain Lion. Even Linux, even desktop Linux, Ubuntu has this Ubuntu One service and has for a little while, sort of does something very similar. And Google, right, is trying to do it with, there's rumors, or did we even hear something about Google, the G Drive, that's been long rumored and sort of always out there on the horizon. It looks like that's coming as well. So, I think you're right. All these platforms are moving towards sort of cloud first. And that these devices that we have, either on our desk or in our bag or in our hand, in our pocket, all these things are just going to access, the computer, which really the computer is the cloud. I think we've been talking about it for a long time, but it's kind of here now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and even Mozilla, right, which produces the Firefox web browser and is considered, you know, the great web citizen, right, always trying to push back against the Googles and the Apples in their quest to cloister off parts of our world, our digital world. I think they're in, you know, they announced this week a big push on this browser ID system, which, again, you know, I think the problem everybody's encountering is you've got all these devices now. You've got your phone, which is really a computer. You've got a tablet, which is also a computer. You've got your laptop and your desktop. You kind of want all this stuff to work across these things. You need unified identities or logins. So what was it called? Oh, the Persona Project, right. So, which Mozilla launched to kind of have a distributed mode of like an account manager, right? You know, and we're not on our desktops anymore. And I think, you know, if you want to view Apple in a kind light, right, all they're doing is they're saying, hey, look, you know, we're just trying to make this stuff work everywhere. And so you got your stuff everywhere, right? And that's what all these places are trying. I mean, all, you know, Google and Microsoft are as well. But in doing that, I just don't see how the existing, you know, university regulations and regulations outside of these, I mean, libraries, records that libraries keep. If they start getting uploaded to the cloud, you know, that's really problematic. I mean, user records, right?
It's so fascinating because there really is such a, I don't know, cognitive dissonance or something. I saw this a little bit in the recent story about the sort of all of your contact info being uploaded, you know, when you didn't know it. Thing, you know, that during that whole conversation, the cognitive dissonance I'm talking about is that people, users, you know, we all want all of our devices to work well and to sync with one another. And then at the same time, we freak out a little bit once we find out that the way that those sync all the time is that all of our information is being stored somewhere in the cloud, somewhere centrally. And then we worry about those companies' access to that records. So it's almost like, you know, well, pick one or the other. You know, either have all of your devices isolated from one another, or figure out ways to feel comfortable with the fact that something, somebody centrally somewhere has the kind of master record of all of that.
What I think is so interesting about this is that these companies that have very, very different histories are all converging, it seems like, on the same thing, on the same space, on the same ideas that, you know, Microsoft, which is, you know, purely a software company, and Apple, which was, you know, kind of a hardware company and really kind of an iPod company for a long time, and Mozilla, which made, you know, this open source browser, and Google, which was really, you know, sort of a data services company. They're all kind of pushing, you know, into the same thing. Another announcement this week that was kind of interesting was that Mozilla is actually working on a thin client mobile operating system, which basically would run on the Linux kernel, but would boot up directly in the same way that kind of Chrome OS boots up directly into the Chrome browser. This would boot up directly on your phone into the mobile Firefox browser. You know, they're all kind of, you know, they're all pushing into this space where, you know, the thing you have with you all the time is your phone, and all these devices kind of access the same data in the cloud, and get their apps from the cloud and get their it's very interesting, you know. Well, and
it's interesting that you bring up the Chrome OS and the Chromebooks, because I took it out of the lineup, but I did notice recently that a number of schools had made a deal to start using Chromebooks. And what's interesting about that is that those Chromebooks are not tied to G Drive yet, right? Because G Drive doesn't exist. They are just assuming that you're storing your data probably in places like Google Docs, but not necessarily in one Google-controlled central organization. So it's one thing to have a device that, you know, is a thin client, as you said, and it's another thing to have that thin client very tightly tied into one company's central servers, basically. So I think that were the case, you know, schools in particular might be a little bit more nervous about adopting things like Chromebooks.
Right.
Well, anyway, there's a lot to watch in that space. The general move to the cloud, it makes me think that at the very least there's a market opportunity for somebody to provide something that isn't tied to the cloud, something completely off of the cloud. But meanwhile, there's a great deal of news in the general news category of open access. One of the more interesting of those news stories is that Australia's National Health and Medical Research Council has said that it will require that published biomedical research be stored in institutional repositories and made publicly accessible within 12 months of publication. There are a number of other stories that we could talk about that are less positive than this in terms of open access. But I thought that this was an interesting story, particularly in relationship to the debates we've been having in the U.S. over things like the Research Works Act. Tom and Dan, what do you know about this this initiative? And do you think that we could ever get something like this in the U.S.?
Well, I thought we have something sort of like this. I'm sorry, I'm a little bit behind on this story in Australia. I mean, I think it is interesting that, all these countries are just wrestling with what the appropriate, policies should be. And you know, I just think within the context of this firestorm around the Research Works Act, which I think was a little bit unexpected from commercial publishers like Elsevier, who's really borne the brunt of it. You know, I just think that in some ways it's going to backfire and you'll see more of these things. I mean, I think there was also a European declaration, trying to pull up right now, on also in favor of open access, sort of supporting these things. You know, I just think the issue is falling onto these questions around what the value added is of the publishers, right? And, you know, I think people are now, and I think it's healthy, I think they're really looking carefully at, you know, what, how publishing happens, who's involved, you know, what work gets done for free, what work gets done, you know, at a price. And I just think it's a generally a healthy discussion for, you know, national bodies to have.
Yeah, you're right. I guess I had misunderstood, but you're right. This is more, for some reason I had thought that the U.S. NIH policy, anyway, I was wrong. I misspoke. You're right. This, what Australia is doing is more like what we do already have in the U.S., where the NIH similarly requires that things that it pays for be stored in an institutional repository.
Right. I mean, this is the kind of the PubMed model.
Yeah.
Well, actually, let's see, public, yeah, institutional repositories, right? So it's,
right.
You know, it's really, you know, it, this is not high bar to clear, right? And what's really crazy about this situation that I think I've yet to get a good answer on is there are no studies, none I've seen, and I've seen people ask for them, journalists and others. There's no research that shows that open access policies like this, especially ones with these windows of monopoly publication at for 6 or 12 months, right, before it goes open access. They do not affect commercial publishers whatsoever. I mean, there's been no scientific study of any kind, right, that has shown that this has affected these publishers. And indeed, I think, Tom, you tweeted last week, I mean, the, you know, Elsevier's profits were up 4%, you know, even in the face of these open access requirements. So, you know, I just don't get it. It's just it's a kind of shameless power grab when you can't show that it's hurting them at all. So what are we discussing, right?
Well, we're discussing the Research Works Act, among other things,
yeah,
which if it were to pass, which I can't imagine that it will, would make things like the NIH's requirement for these things to be stored in open repositories illegal, right?
Well, right. I mean, yeah, right. But so what, you know, it's not...
So they must believe, they must at least believe it's going to hurt their business.
Well, right. I mean, there is... Right.
I think over time, I think over time they're right. I mean, I think... In this, you know, in this transitionary period where, you know, you still need, you know, you still need the publication in the Elsevier, you know, owned or published journal for, you know, tenure and promotion. You still, you know, senior colleagues are still going to look in those journals first for their research sources, where scholarly societies and other bodies are still under contract with those, you know, sometimes very long-term contracts, 10 years, with the big publishers. I think, you know, it's in that case, the libraries still have to buy the subscriptions and their profits don't decline. But, you know, 10, 15 years into open access mandates, when, you know, everybody comes to realize the stuff is out there for free and all of the good stuff is out there for free, then I think it does. I mean, I think they're really looking at a kind of longer term future. And I think they're right to be nervous. I mean, you know, and they've got the money to pay lobbyists. So I mean, it makes sense. You know, I'm optimistic about the Australian efforts and the European efforts. and efforts in other countries to institute these open access mandates. Because one thing that I don't think that those countries have, I mean, I think partly because they're smaller, partly because their countries put less money into medical research than the U.S. does, and other things. You know, I think that they're not going, and partly their political systems are different than ours. They're not going to face the kind of lobbying that we are. Like, it would, you know, the Australian medical body, I can't remember the name of it, makes an open access mandate, I think it can kind of fly under the radar a little bit more than if the NIH does it. And it may be kind of a backdoor into some of these things. So I'm actually very, very optimistic about these kind of smaller country efforts. You know, obviously we want it to happen in the US, but if we get some setbacks here, if they're still pushing forward, I think that makes a lot of difference.
Yeah, it's funny, Tom. I read a fantastic piece by the real person behind the fake Twitter account, Fake Elsevier. And I'm sorry, I've forgotten his name. I'll have to look it up and put it in the show notes. But he wrote a non-satiric letter about the Elsevier boycott. And part of what he said was, you know, the Elsevier boycott is all very well. You know, of course, he's entirely supportive of it. But his position was that, look, the scientists, you know, even though they contribute all the free labor of peer review and so on, are not really in the position of power here. It's the funding organizations that are in the position of power. If they create these mandates, scientists will follow them. Just, you know, it's as simple as that. I mean, a boycott, even one that, you know, seems to be doing as well as this Elsevier boycott, is not going to get everyone to stop publishing in Elsevier journals, to stop peer reviewing for Elsevier journals. If a funding organization says your work has to be open access, that's it. It's done. That work is going to be open access within a particular amount of time. So, you know, I thought that was a good point.
I think one of the most interesting discussions that I saw on this was on a scientist website, actually a science blogger. I think it was Bora's site. But someone pointed out that, you know, open access doesn't mean profitless. And one of the mandates that they could have would just be to mandate gold open access, where researchers have to pay a body like Elsevier to do the reviewing. I think Elsevier charges around $3,000 for an article. And they have an open access unit. I mean, it's not like they haven't done some work in open access, although I did some research on it, and it looks like last year they only published 120 articles under this subvention rule that they've got, where you can sort of pay extra to liberate your article through them. So obviously not that many people are doing it, but they clearly have priced it to make money, right? If they're a business, and they figured out a price that they will review an article, publish it, get into their discovery tools, which people also pay for it, the discovery tools, by the way. Those are very profitable services that they provide. And, you know, so someone asked on this blog, and actually someone from Elsevier showed up and sort of engaged them on this question of, well, you know, would you be for, rather than, you know, depositing it in a institutional repository for free, would you be in favor, let's say NIH just hypothetically said, well, you have to, you know, pay someone to do the review and pay them to open access it, make sure that they get enough money to, you know, do all the stuff that publishers do, that value added part of it. And it was interesting. I mean, the response was sort of like, well, we'd be more open to that, obviously, because it would preserve their profits. But they don't like mandates at all, right? And they fell back on this language of, you know, very clever. And when you live in Washington for a while, you realize some of these phrases. So, like, government mandates is a great, like, tested phrase. It really is,
it's
right?
It's like the ideological intrusion. Bell going off.
Right, know, so. That's right. So we don't like mandates of any kind. The government shouldn't mandate anything. But that's what I'm saying is, I think there's just more ways to look at this that make you realize that the sky is not falling. And I mean, it is interesting to see that as the Public Library of Science launched PLOS One, publish things, you know, without review, right? There's now commercial publishers that are emulating this because they realize it's a way to make money as well.
You know, one thing that sort of, this is maybe a little off topic, but it sort of annoys me actually to think that, I don't think paying for peer review, the journals paying for peer review, is necessarily something that I would, doesn't offend me, but it's not something I would necessarily be on board with, just because it seems like it should be university's responsibility. Like it should be like the faculty do that kind of thing as part of their job as faculty, it seems to me. But of course, it's not really recognized in tenure and review, so that some people cut back on it when they, you know, are up for that kind of thing. I don't know. It almost doesn't seem like the journal's responsibility to pay for that to me. It seems like that right now it's a kind of an in-kind donation from the universities to knowledge in general. And in fact, yeah. I've often thought that, you know, it should be universities in general or granting organizations that should pay the costs of publication, you know.
I mean, if there is, you know, I mean, there is a, I agree. I mean, you know, this is done, this, you know, peer review in all disciplines is done essentially as pro bono labor by faculty. But I mean, there is a cost in, you know, I mean, it really is what the cost to the publisher or to whatever body is conducting the peer review. I mean, really is hiring the person who sits there and harangues faculty to get their reviews in. And that
it's
is a real cost.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a full-time job.
You know, like, and having that person who sends you, you know, hey, you said this, you were going to have this for me on, you know, February 15th. It's already February 24th. When can I expect it? You know, that person has to be paid a salary. And so, I mean, there are some real honest to goodness costs in here.
So maybe publishers should just say, well, we're going to pay you for peer review, but we're not going to pay you until you get it done. Maybe then you don't have to have a person who is the haranguer.
Yeah. Yeah. I still need haranguing.
Yeah. That was a joke. I'm not really in favor of that.
Meanwhile, I mean, that is, I think, the most interesting part of the Elsevier boycott, which we should note as an update to the last podcast, is now over 7,000 scholars have signed on at thecostofknowledge.com. And I think that is the Achilles heel here is, I mean, just looking at, for instance, mathematics, I think they're approaching 1,000 mathematicians, and a lot of them, you know, big name mathematicians. And if those people are, you know, get a call or an email from the haranguer at Elsevier and they say, hey, you know, too bad. And they're one of the only experts worldwide who know a very small area of pure mathematics, which really, I mean, it does happen that there are just not that many reviewers in certain areas. It is possible to kind of reach a critical mass where it starts hindering a journal in a fairly circumscribed field like pure mathematics or associated fields. So I'm kind of interested to see how that part of it plays out. Not necessarily the part of, you know, I refuse to publish in the Elsevier ones, but the Elsevier journals, but the, you know, I refuse to answer the call from the haranguer. Well,
right.
What happens
do they end
then?
Up with a do they end up with, like, it's a bottleneck in the pipeline?
Yeah, and especially if, you know, oftentimes this is someone who's in their field, right? You know, it's someone from, let's say, the editorial board at a journal who's also a mathematician. Then you say, you know, hey, you know, Tom, you know, look, I've signed on to this thing. You should think about it too, right? I mean, there's something that could be a little bit viral about it too.
There is something tribal about it. I mean, when I'm doing peer review and so on, I mean, it's because I feel a social connection to the members of my discipline who are publishing those pieces, you know. It's not anything to do with money at all. I mean, it's not something that I do for pay. It's something that I do because of what I guess you would call social pressure, but it isn't pressure. I'm happy to do it. I want to contribute to knowledge. I want to read the papers, you know, see if they're any good, see if they contribute to my knowledge, see if I can help make them better. So, yeah.
I mean, it could be that, you know, and I'm sure they are. It could be that Elsevier and other publishers are counting on the strength of those social bonds to pull them through this, where, you know, Dan, you're the journal, you're the editor for an Elsevier journal. You call me up and say, hey, you know, you promised to do this thing for me. And I say, yeah, but I'm, you know, I've got this political statement to make. And you say, hey, but my ass is on the line. I say, all right, you know,
yeah.
I'll do it. You know,
love
I mean,
to be a fly on the wall. Yep.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I actually did some peer reviewing for an MLA publication a while ago, and I realized after I had done that, you know, and they were people that I knew who had written the pieces. They were people that I knew who were running the journal, and I realized after that, I was like, oh, profession is not open access. As it happened, that particular journal, they did specifically make some of the content open access. But it didn't, you know, I mean, I talk about this stuff all the time. It didn't even occur to me, like, while I was doing the review.
Yeah, you know, and I've turned down reviewing opportunities. It's also, there's a, I think some people could use some boilerplate on what the email response should be, you know, because I've, you know,
dear harangue.
I don't know. I, you don't want to be like totally a jerk, right? You know, you want to make your point, but don't want to be sanctimonious, right? And so I, you know, I've gone back and forth on the language I've used. You know, in certain cases, I've just used the totally appropriate cop out that I'm too busy, which I am. But in other cases, you know, I've been pretty direct and I've said, you know, look, I'm sorry, I'm not going to give you my free labor for this commercial publication. And not that I'm opposed to commercial publications, but it's like a lot of my time and you're profiting from that. And I'd much rather this scholarship be open access. So, you know, I think, you know, again, I've kind of beaten this to death on Twitter, but I think there could be a good website that just provided some kind of pragmatic advice like this, like how should you respond? Or a site that says, you know, if you're thinking about publishing in profession, right? You know, it could just be like a drop down menu where you just type in the journal you're thinking of publishing in, and it would give you an option for an open access journal that's maybe not equally as good in terms of brand name, but equally as good in terms of getting your scholarship out, but it would get it out in an open access way.
Or even advice on how to, you know, how to modify contracts. For monographs and stuff,
right.
You know, like where they give you the boilerplate contract and like what to look for in the contract that is going to prevent, you know, your scholarship from getting out there and the kinds of changes that you might suggest that publishers, you know, may agree to and the kinds of things that you can suggest that they're not going to agree to.
I think libraries have some of that. I mean, I forget where, but a lot of
Those things exist, but they're, you know, again, they're, you got to like Google the heck out of them to find them. And I think there could is a role for some big website on this. And there are some tricks. I mean, I've published in venues one relatively recently where, you know, I really said, look, I want to post this on my personal website. And, you know, there was a lot of back and forth. You know, we came up with language that was mutually agreeable for, you know, where, you know, I'm willing to compromise in certain circumstances. And, you know, I said to them, look, you know, you can have your, you know, nicely laid out galley version of this. I'm not going to like take your PDF that you sent me and post it on my website, but I keep my text and I can put this up as a blog post, you know, and reformat it myself.
And
line edit it myself. You know, I'm going to take that version. And so you can come up with language about, you know, in its final version, you can have that, but I'm going to take another version, right? And that's what the whole idea of a preprint is.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, when I first got into this whole library world and people were tossing around terms like preprints and postprints, it took me a while to figure that out, that like the preprint is your Word doc and the postprint is their carefully formatted galley proof.
Right, PDF. But sometimes this doesn't quite work. And so I think, you know, again, there's little tweaks that you can make. But then, you know, it does come down to scholars being put into tough positions. And I think we could use some further discussion about the, you know, sort of pragmatic ways you make your way through that.
So you guys have both been publishing for a long time, I'm imagining. Do you feel like this has changed a lot, like since the early days of when we all started publishing, that both publishers and scholars are more aware of intellectual property and copyright issues? Just because I had this experience where I think it was the very first article, I haven't even published that much, but the very first scholarly article I published, I was already into the web thing. And I asked them, I was like, can I put a copy of this up on my website? And the guy wrote me back. He's like, why would I care about that? Sure, go ahead if you want to. Why would you want to? But fine. I always wondered if other people had those experiences too.
I mean, I'm sort of in your boat, Amanda, where I haven't published very much. And what I have published, I think, you know, I've always come at it from this angle where, you know, I sort of started on the web and moved into print. And so it's always been kind of like, yes, you know, like I didn't go that route in my career. So it hasn't really been a problem for me. I kind of made a name for myself before I needed to have those kinds of arguments. And by the time I had to have those kinds of arguments, I was in a position to kind of win them. But I think for most people, they're pretty much in the boat of you're doing it the traditional way. I mean, I don't think it's changed a whole lot in the humanities. Dan, what do you think?
You know, I've found there are more, people are more aware of it, and the ranks of enlightened publishers who are willing to consider open access versions have grown absolutely in the last 10 years. But there's still, you know, a lot of resistance. And I think we're in this like weird little eddy of academia. You know, I think for 90% of the scholars out there, they get a contract, they sign it, they're just happy to have their stuff published. They don't think about these things. And, you know, that's ultimately why this is going to take a lot longer. I thought Timothy Gower, who kind of sparked this whole Elsevier boycott, he had a really nice piece, I think it was in The Guardian, sort of explaining himself a bit more. And he said, look, you know, I know this one thing isn't going to change it, but it's gotten the discussion going in my profession of mathematics, and that's healthy. And maybe it's going to take 20 years, and especially it might take 20 years to get outlets, to get new journals that are open access that have the same brand names as some of the existing ones. But, you know, let's start now. And, you know, maybe it's just because I'm like older now, but I do think it's sort of a generational scale change, that it's just going to take a lot longer, and it's going to be fought at, you know, it might be a global fight, but it's going to be fought at the local level of individual scholars questioning contracts, advocating, people who are in the position to win arguments, to win them, and then to tout that win without being a jerk about it, just to say, you know, I really appreciate this press being willing to publish my stuff, open access at the same time. And hey, also they sold lots of copies of the thing itself in print. So it didn't seem to hurt that bad, right? It's just publicized. It's just sort of the constant thing. And I think, so if you think about it in that way, if you think about it more like, you know, not a one-year revolution, but more like the environmental movement, which started in the 60s and 70s and people kind of poo-pooed it. And, you know, there were slogans that seemed kind of empty, like, you know, think globally and act locally and things like that. But over time, it had an effect, right? And as people got access to sort of practical, relatively easy ways to recycle and sort of do things in a more environmentally friendly way, then it changed the mindset. And I just think this is one of those cases.
I think you're definitely right about scholars' perspectives. What I would be interested to find out, and maybe there's a study out there or something like this, is what's in those contracts that scholars are signing without thinking about it. I think that the publishers have been much more aware of these issues, quite obviously, than scholars have. And my sense, my guess, my hypothesis would be that, first of all, they weren't, you know, that those things have gotten more draconian over time. I mean, of course, that, you know, in the earlier days, even mid-90s, they weren't worried about things being published on the internet because they just weren't thinking that way. But my sense is that even in the early days of being able to post things on the websites, the contracts you would sign with a journal or with a university press were much more lenient, I think, in the early days about, like, you know, what can you quote from other people? What constitutes permission to quote or, you know, use an image or something like that? Can you post your own thing on your own website? Can you post it in a course reserve system? My sense is that those contracts are probably forbidding a lot more than they used to these days.
Well, I think there weren't, you know, in a previous generation or even 20 years ago, there weren't that many ways to you know, there weren't that many, many ways to pirate, you know, copyrighted material. I mean, you know, you, there was the photocopier, you know, you could re-key things. But really, there weren't a lot of ways to reuse, republish, you know, remix published text. And so, and now, you know, now it's simple. Now it's easy. And so to the extent that there are more options for what publishers would view as, you know, illicit use, then their contracts have gotten, you know, more specific and more draconian. From their perspective, I think they probably think that, you know, our contracts have gotten worse because people are stealing more.
Right. I mean, but I'm wondering, I guess even say, you know, pre-internet days, whatever that might be, say 1985 or something, which isn't, you know, entirely pre-internet, but you know what I mean, pre-web, popularization of the internet. I mean, maybe they were just taking everybody's copyright, you know, full stop. And we didn't notice because, as you say, there wasn't enough to do with that stuff. You know, it was as published as it was going to be by that publisher. I don't know. It'd just be interesting. I should look into it myself.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that there's a possibility that the pendulum, you know, swings the other way because of digital publishing. I think we saw that in the Oxford University Press contract that someone had posted on the web that asked for someone to sign off as a their writing as work for hire,
right.
Basically assigning all rights to OUP, who would technically become the owner. It could do anything with that writing. And that's right. The reason why, I mean, if I'm to be generous to OUP, I think the reason they're doing that is probably because some lawyer looked at the digital landscape and said, oh man, well, we have to reproduce this in our discovery search tool. And we may have to, you know, put this on through the Kindle store. And like, I'm looking at the Kindle, like Amazon's contract, and gosh, this would all be so much easier if we never had to talk to this author again. Mm-hmm. Right. And so that's what's really both scary and, you know, at the same time that we have this like moment of flourishing of open access, I think there's another path that some publishers would like to take where, you know, it's the opposite of this, to make their lives easier, to be able for them to reproduce it in electronic media, as the contracts often say, that they need to get more rights from us, right?
Well, I think that has been our open access hour. I'm now in the mood to hire a haranguer of my own. I could use a haranguer. So let me know if we can.
Don't we have one of those here at the center? I think we've got a haranguer.
I need someone to, actually, probably I need someone to harangue me. I need to hire someone to harangue me to blog and things like that. So I'm excited about that. I'm excited we've come up with that that idea. We toast our absent colleague, Mills Kelly, who has lost his voice, I forgot to mention entirely, which is why he's not here. I think I'm in the process of maybe losing mine, but I have not lost it yet. So I will use my voice to bid you all a fond farewell until the next episode of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv. where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself. Thank you.